Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Jodcast. Happy birthday to you.
The Jodcast. Happy birthday to us. With Megan Argo, Adam Overson, George Bendo, Therese Canwell, Hannah Stacey, and Charlie Walker. The Jodcast. January 2016, birthday edition. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of the Jodcast. I'm Charlie, and I'm here with Megan, Adam, and George.
Hello.
Hello.
And it's a special day because the Jodcast is 10 years old.
Woo!
Yay!
And only one of us here has been around since the very beginning.
Yeah, I feel really old right now.
Ah. You're the last one in the department who's still around.
Yeah, I did leave and come back, though. Mm. And I haven't been doing it for the whole 10 years, as I'm sure the listeners will have noticed.
Have you been listening to it regularly for 10 years?
I should say yes, but I would be lying.
Adam, I think you're one of the people who's contributed the longest continuously.
By virtue of having never left, yeah. I've been going since 2009, helping out on the Jodcast, but I don't know. Probably me or Megan have you had a break, right?
I did. Well, I did the news for 7 years almost continuously. There were only a handful of episodes, first of the month episodes, where I didn't do the news. But then, yeah, I stopped for a bit.
Moved on. We've had regular newscasters ever since.
Yes.
And I think Mateus is going to be taking over as one of them. What about you, George? How long have you been going for?
Since about 2012, though I'm not actually certain. It's started working at Georgia Bank Center for Astrophysics 5 years ago, actually, to this day that we're recording.
Oh, wow.
Soon after moving up here, and also I was moving up here from London, where at Imperial College, the people there wanted us all focused on research and didn't really want us doing other things like outreach and stuff. So I didn't start right away on the Jodcast. It's like I sort of gradually started working on it. So I don't recall exactly when I started working on it, but it was 2011 or 2012.
Well, one thing's certain, I'm definitely the freshest here, so I'm not really sure why I'm leading.
Had you listened to it before you started your studies?
No, I was always pretty bad at listening to things and watching things about astronomy on TV, to be honest. So I don't know how I've ended up doing this. But
you're doing a very good job.
Cheers. So the Jodcast is 10 and almost old enough to learn about what we're talking about, I guess. And I'll do my best. So in the show this time, we interview Professor John Serodakis about the Antikythera mechanism, and Joe Zuntz answers your astronomical questions.
But first, before all of that, Therese Cantwell interviews Dr. Jean-Francois Robitaille about measuring magnetic fields in the galactic plane in this month's JodBite.
So my name is Therese Cantwell, and I'm here today with Jean-Francois Robitaille. He's a postdoc at University of Manchester, and he did his PhD in Université Laval. So what were you doing your PhD on then?
So the title of my PhD was the multiscale analysis of the dust emission in the galactic plane. I was working with mathematical tools to separate different kind of fluctuations in the dust emission in the galactic plane.
And so there's just a lot of dust floating about in the galaxy.
Yeah, there's a lot of dust. And dust is a really good tracer to the... like the entire amount of matter along the line of sight, because we think that is homogeneously mixed with the molecular gas and the atomic gas as well. So it's a good tracer to like the entire amount of matter in the interstellar medium.
So it's a good way of effectively seeing what the galaxy really looks like, where everything is, the distribution of matter in the galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. So during my PhD, I used the map of the Special Telescope Herschel.
And are you working on the same stuff then here in Manchester, or...?
It's a bit different. So in my position here, I'm still working with similar mathematical tools that we could discuss a bit more later. Now, they are applied on the magnetic field of the galactic plane. So I try to understand the structures in the magnetic field.
So is there a magnetic field distributed throughout the whole of the galaxy, or do you only get magnetic field in small areas of the galaxy?
So there's magnetic fields almost everywhere in the galaxy. So usually people tend to separate it in two different ways. So you have the regular magnetic field and the random magnetic field. So the regular one is at the large scales of the galaxies. So the scale of the galactic arm, for example.
So the spiral arms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So at that scale, we see that the magnetic fields follow the galactic arms. At smaller spatial scales, we see that the magnetic field is more random, and it's probably caused by turbulence and energy that is ejected by supernova and also massive stars, winds, stellar winds.
So how do we actually see magnetic fields in the galaxy? Are we able to just point a telescope at the galaxy and see these? Or
yeah, it would be really useful, but no, we cannot do that. So that's the main problem with the magnetic fields, that we cannot observe it directly. So we have to use tracers to do that. There's no perfect tracers, but we have many many ways to see it.
What are some examples of these tracers?
We have, for example, if we want to look at the larger scales, which is the larger fluctuations in the galactic plane, we'll look at what we call the extragalactic sources. So we look at
these sources outside of our own galaxy, like other galaxies or
exactly.
Like that.
So it's usually emitted by AGN, so active galactic nucleus.
Ah, so supermassive black holes at the center.
Yeah, exactly. So they emit polarized light. Polarization, maybe the best comparison we can do is with when you look at a 3D movie in IMAX. Usually they use glasses with two different filters. So back in the old days, it was the blue and the red filter. But now they use polarized filter on the glasses.
So this is why when you look at someone else wearing the glasses, you can't, one of the eyes is darkened out?
Yeah, exactly.
Because the light can't get through both.
Yeah, exactly. So the polarization of light measure is the quantification of the orientation of the electric wave in the electromagnetic emission light.
So whether the emission is going up and down or left and right or...
Yeah, exactly.
Clockwise or anti-clockwise.
So there's a lot of polarized emission in the in space or in the universe. So the extragalactic sources by the AGN are polarized. So when we look at the extragalactic sources, which emit polarized, polarized emission, the light experience what we call the Faraday rotation. So the Faraday rotation is the rotation of the angle of the polarization vector or the angle of the oscillations of light. That rotation is dependent of the magnetic field strength in the galaxy. Also, it's dependent of the density of thermal electron. So a lot of the part of the matter in the interstellar medium is a plasma, which is just matter that is ionized by the fields of radiation in interstellar medium. It's also dependent of the square of the wavelength of the emission.
Okay. So we can infer magnetic fields are there because we can see
the amount of
rotating emission from extragalactic sources.
Exactly.
But this isn't the technique you use.
No, that's not the technique that I use. So one main problem with that technique is that we don't have enough sources to sample all the oscillations or all the differences in the magnetic field in the galactic plane. One really good thing about this technique is that we can measure the entire effect because we use extragalactic sources, so we can see the effect of the entire galaxy because the light is coming from outside of the galaxy.
Yeah,
outside of the galaxy. Since we don't have enough sources, we cannot sample the entire fluctuations of the galactic plane. There's other way to do that. We can also use pulsars, which are in our galaxies. That way we can infer some distances to the magnetic field fluctuation in our galaxy. Another way is to use the dust polarization as well. So we think that dust grains has an elongated shape. That shape is aligned with the magnetic field lines. So the emission, the infrared emission of the dust is also polarized because of that alignment with the magnetic field. So we can do that, but it's still not perfect because we trace the magnetic field where this matter. So if we really want to trace the magnetic field itself, the best way is probably with the diffuse polarized galactic emission.
And so what's diffuse polarized galactic emission then?
Okay. So the galaxy itself emitting the polarized emission. It's what we call the synchrotron emission. Mm-hmm. So it's when the free electrons that I mentioned before, the thermal electrons that come from the ionization of the matter in the interstellar medium. So those free electrons are captured or accelerated by the magnetic field lines, and then those electrons emit polarized emission. Mm-hmm. That emission is visible in the radio, so that's why we are using radio telescope.
So which radio telescopes are you using then for your work?
So for my work, I don't observe personally for that, but I'm using surveys that look at the entire galaxy. The first survey that I used was the Canadian Galactic Plane Survey, which is a survey of the, like I said, the entire galactic plane. It was at 1.4 gigahertz. Now I'm using another one, which comes from Australia, the SPAS survey for the S-band polarization all sky survey. So for this one, it's really interesting because we not only have the galactic plane, but we have the entire sky. So we can compare the emission at higher galactic latitude mm-hmm. and also the more random field, magnetic field in the galactic plane itself.
So what results have you seen then with your new mathematical techniques?
Okay, so with my technique, I focus mainly on the random part of the magnetic field. That's the random part is mainly affected by the turbulence. Turbulence has the ability to transfer the energy from larger scales to smaller scales. We think that the main energy sources, the large scales...
The drivers for the turbulence.
Yeah, exactly, is probably the supernova in the galaxy.
So that would that be large-scale turbulence then?
Yeah, but this large scale energy then cascade from mm-hmm. larger scales to smaller scales. So that's why we see fluctuations and randomness in the interstellar medium. But it's not completely random. And with my technique, I try to separate structures that are random or maybe turbulent from structures that are not turbulent mm-hmm. and try to understand the link between many physical processes like massive stellar winds to determine what is that scale of ejection mm-hmm. in the galaxy. And for that, I'm using mathematical tools which are called wavelets. So the main idea with wavelets is that the main goal is to separate the different scale, and the best comparison that we can do is with a piece of music, for example. If we want to look at the frequency content of a piece of music, we'll do the Fourier transform of it. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see the piece of music not as a function of time, but as a function of frequencies. And then we can tell how there's that frequency or this frequency in the piece of music. The difference with the wavelets is that we can not only say that there's that frequency or that frequency, but we can also tell where the frequency was during the piece of music. Mm-hmm. Those frequencies, there's also spatial frequencies in images, so we can decompose an image in different scales and different spatial frequencies. And for that, I'm using wavelets. And from that decomposition, we can tell many things. So we can quantify the turbulent medium by saying if it's, for example, subsonic, supersonic, and stuff like that. We can also tell the scale of the injection of the energy. Unfortunately, it's really hard to tell the scale at which complete dissipation of the energy, because for the moment, we don't have the resolution to do that.
So effectively, so when you look at an image initially, all these different spatial scales are superimposed, and it's impossible just looking at the image to disentangle these.
It's really hard to do.
So the usefulness of your method is that you can actually apply this, and it opens that up for you. You can then see the different different scales.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that we can do only recently, because before those surveys that I was mentioning, we didn't have enough larger scales, if you want. So we just looked at some places in our galaxy, mm-hmm. so like a star formation region, or what is the magnetic field in a supernova region, mm-hmm. and things like that. But now with the surveys, we have access to the fluctuation in the entire galactic plane or for the entire galaxy. And then we have access to the larger scales. So now we can see and try to measure with this kind of tools, the wavelet transform or Fourier transform, try to see what is the connection between the different scales in the turbulent medium.
And so you mentioned that at the moment telescopes aren't good enough to be able to see down to that the smallest scales.
Yeah.
Is there hope in the future that these might be accessible?
Yeah. there's hope. So there's a lot of development for the next generation of radio telescope, or the SKA. So I tried to look at some numbers that are impressive, some stuff that we're...
So the SKA is the telescope being built in South Africa and Australia.
Yeah,
is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It will have a lot more telescope and more telescope or the more... Yeah, not just the sensitivity, but the number of antenna and the...
baselines, the distances between
exactly.
the antenna?
Yeah, the baselines. Longest baselines, we can have access to smaller features, if you want, in the images, and reach a better resolution with our observation. So with that, yeah, maybe at that point we'll be able to look at the point where we have a dissipation of the energy in the... And it's something that is really important to understand, for example, the formation of molecular clouds, which are...
The birthplace of new stars?
Of stars, yeah exactly. So that will be very interesting. Also, SKA will be more sensitive, like you said. When I mentioned, for example, the extragalactic sources. So at the moment, I said that we don't have enough sampling to look at the smallest fluctuation, so we don't... We have only access to the large scales fluctuation, or the large scale image of the magnetic field in the galaxy with that technique.
So this is the Faraday rotation technique, using the extragalactic sources.
Extragalactic sources. Yeah. So now at the moment we have access to catalog of extragalactic sources of approximately 40,000 sources. But with the sensitivity of the SKA, we'll have like between 7 and 14 extragalactic sources.
Oh, million extragalactic sources,
yeah.
Is it? Yeah. That's a significant jump up.
Yeah, exactly. So with that, we will have a better sampling of the magnetic field of the entire galaxy. There's some limitations with the when we look at the diffuse polarized galactic emission, what I'm doing. There's some advantage to use... the extragalactic sources.
So we'll be able to do an awful lot more so once the SKA comes online. In when is the SKA due to begin operation?
So I think the construction should begin around 2018.
Okay, so still a couple of years away.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, still there's a lot of work to do.
In the meantime.
In the meantime, yeah. And it's also the role of our group here in Manchester with an archive, so to imagine some new science that we'll be able to do with the SKA, and also developing the pipeline of reductions of data and things like that.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming to talk to us today.
Thanks a lot to you.
Thanks for that, Therese. Now, if you're interested in hearing about a 2,000-year-old astronomical computer, such a thing does exist, Charlie interviewed Professor John Seradakis about the Antikythera mechanism.
Today I'm joined by Professor John Seradakis, who's the director of the Laboratory of Astronomy at Aristotle University. Welcome to the Jocast.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed my lecture today and I'm enjoying talking to you.
And you did your PhD in Manchester a while back, didn't you?
Lovely times, back in 71 to 75.
And that was back when the University of Manchester was still the Victoria University of Manchester.
Indeed, yes. And UMass was different.
And you lived, I guess you lived at Jodrell Bank.
Well, there were no premises at Jodrell Bank. I lived in Alderley Edge with Richard Davis and other friends that were here today.
Yeah, with lots of academics who we've interviewed here in the past.
Yes.
And Ian Morrison, who does our Sky at Night.
Yes.
So you were here giving a talk on the Antikythera mechanism, which is, I guess the best way to describe it, you're one of the leading experts in the subject. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Antikythera mechanism actually is?
Well, it was an astronomical computer. It had input, output, and it had a way of doing calculations through gears. It was calculating the position of the sun and the moon. It was calculating and forecasting eclipses of the sun and the moon. And it was also, it had a well-made user's manual because it was a complicated device.
listening to your talk, some of the stuff is incredible about how they've actually manufactured this thing. Could you give us a little bit of history on when it was discovered?
It was discovered by chance in 1901 by some fishermen, probably it was sponge divers. And once the discovery was made, a few months later, the whole crew of archaeologists and other personnel from the Greek Navy, they collaborated and they brought up several artifacts, statues, jewelry, glassware, and the Antikythera mechanism.
A couple of months is quite a quick turnaround for discovering something to actually bring it up, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. This is something that couldn't happen today, I think, with all the precautions and the bureaucracy that we have, especially in my country.
Yeah. So what drew you to first look at this mechanism? Because your research is in neutron stars and flare stars and, wow, pretty much everything, the center of the galaxy. But you're also really interested in archaeoastronomy. So what drew you to this particular area?
I haven't said this before, but my mother was an archaeologist. She worked with Sir Arthur Evans in Crete, and she gave me the microbe of archaeology through the blood that she transferred to me. So when Mike Edmonds gave me a ring and said, well, shall we try to make another investigation of the Antikythera mechanism, I was very happy, except I did not want to do the bureaucracy. Mm. I called a colleague of mine, and he said, yes, I will do the bureaucracy for you, but you do the astronomy. Fair enough, he would do it, but eventually his health deteriorated and I had to do everything. And I was not very good at bureaucracy, so it took us 2 years before he got the permission to actually investigate it.
What sort of bureaucracy does happen? How do you get to the point where you can actually pick up this thing, this fragment, which is so old and so precious?
Well, I think the archaeologists are the guardians of our inheritance, the guardians of history. So they're very, very, very careful what they do and what permissions they give. At the beginning, they did not understand what we were trying to do. They did not know what X-rays really mean. They did not know anything about gears. They did not know that by studying the number of teeth of cooperating gears, we can understand what they are doing. Mm. So it took us a very long time until we persuaded them that it's going to bring new results. And it has brought new results.
Yeah, it's incredible. Could you quickly give a description of what the Antikythera mechanism is today, what you actually see when you have the pieces out in front of you?
Well, they're fragments. They're calcified fragments of gears, plates, and pointers. And luckily, having the very high-resolution tomographer that we used, we can go through it. We have a resolution of 20 microns and read letters, see the gears, how they cooperate, where the axes are, where the shafts are, and this is what we do.
So layer by layer, you can strip down
yes.
micrometer by micrometer and just unravel yes. what's going on in a really non-invasive way. Which is
yes,
really
yes, exactly, exactly. Non-invasive way, well said. Mm. The problem was, of course, that the fragments were not flat. When we're reading a text, it was not that we read the text on a two-dimensional flat space.
Is that because it was made in not a flat way, or was it because it's been battered and beaten by the waves?
It was battered and bittered and calcified and broken, and maybe there were earthquakes there that stones came down and destroyed it a little bit here and there. We found only about two-fifths of the mechanism.
Wow. So only less than 25% of the mechanism
yes.
you've got there. But from just looking at the gears, you can tell what they do.
Yes. And being astronomers, we know some periodicities. We know how the planets move. We know how the sun and the moon move in the sky. So by studying the ratio of the teeth, of the number of teeth of the gears, we can calculate what they do and then see if you have, say, a train of gears, the first gear transmits a rotation to the second one, to the third one, to the fourth one. So you have to take the ratio of all of them. So like 223 divided by 5. Times 24 divided by 7, etc., etc. We can calculate what is the output at the very last end of the gear train, and then we know what they did. This gear train, what they did.
And how many gears have you got? How many gears do you know what they do?
Yes, we have found and we know for certain that we have about 30 gears. In our reconstruction, we used a few more gears, but they were certain what they were doing. So we were not questioned that there would be some other gear. Because, for example, if you find a pointer saying Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, etc., etc., and you do not know what gear was going through this point, then you say this gear must have seven teeth. So a full rotation would give you a weekly calendar.
So I'm guessing there's a 365-toothed gear.
Yes, okay. There's the gears with 365 teeth, the gears with 223, 224. The smallest one has nine teeth, etc., etc.
And how big is the biggest one, and how big is the smallest one?
Biggest one is 30 centimeters in diameter, and the small one is less than a centimeter. It's about 0.762 centimeters.
So these things, which were crafted from bronze?
Bronze, a combination of copper and tin. In fact, tin was produced in Britain. I mean, most likely the tin could have come from Britain.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Wow. So is that one of the biggest reserves of tin found in ancient Europe?
Well, for ancient times, it is known. There's the traveling experience of Pythias the Greek, who traveled from Marseille, Massalia in Greek, to maybe up to the Orkney Islands. And he describes step by step where he went through, what was the shadow of the sun, so you know the geographical latitude. And he did certainly go through Cornwall. So this is where you have your tin mines.
And it's amazing that, well, some of the stuff that you make it from could have come from all over Europe. And actually, this was found in a shipwreck. Could you give us a bit of history about why it was found off an island called Antikythera, where it gets its name from? How did that come about?
Yes. One of the things that I do not know, and I will start from this, is if it was found in the front of the ship or in the back of the ship. In 1900, they did not record everything accurately. If it was found close to the captain's quarters, this could be a navigational instrument. We have found the word sun ray in the text, and why should an ancient person write the word sun ray on the text? Probably, maybe they had a kind of bamboo and they were pointing at the sun, then measuring the height of the sun. In the same way, they could do the same for planets or for stars, and this is the beginning of actually finding geographic longitude, which is very difficult to find if you do not have a timepiece, but maybe this can be done with tables.
But even 2,000 years ago, I guess this was.
About 2,000 years ago.
And you know that because of the font that's inscribed on the instructions to this mechanism. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, yes. So the Antikythera mechanism has about 3,000 letters on it that we have found, must be many more. And by investigating the style of the letters, we can calculate the age. So, as you say, the font used by the ancient technician, we can calculate what is the age when this machine was built. Nowadays, we're trying to find out through calculating the eclipse cycle that is on the Antikythera mechanism. And this is also gives us a date around the 2nd century BC, as we had calculated from the style of the letters.
So they match. That's a,
yes.
Well, that's a good result to show that you're on the right track. But coming back to what we were talking about. So it was on a ship, and the ship sank. What else was on the ship?
Oh, there were lots of ligini. This is a material made out of clay. In fact, this ligini, these pots, in the ancient times, was what we have today is a plastic bag. So they were actually transporting goods through clay pots. And if they had transported wine or olive oil, then this should be discarded because you cannot put anything else in it. So one way of actually finding out the ancient trade routes is to follow the fragments of broken clay. And this was done by a British archaeologist. And we now know what are the trade routes in ancient times between at least Marseille and Northern Europe. So we have found 104 statues or fragments of these statues, legs, head, bronze arms, etc., etc. It had very good artistic glassware. It had some very nice jewelry. In fact, Monica Jackson from Australia, she has studied these cosmetics, this oil effing they found there, and she has found copies of this in several museums around Europe. One of them is in Delos, one was in somewhere in the Eastern Europe. And so I think what has happened at Delos, which is like the Cayman Islands of the ancient times, so no taxation, there was somebody who was making this jewelry, and then he was selling it. So this is why some was found at Delos, and some was found in other museums. very with high similarities like the ones at the Antikythera mechanism. Mm. So this boat probably, which is a very large boat, probably started from Ephesus, Pergamum, because coins from that era were found, and then it went to Rhodes, Kos, maybe to Symi, maybe to Paros, and then was going through the Straits of Peloponnese to Crete, and there it sank. So it had been collecting, should I call it loot, maybe.
A ship full of treasure.
Is it full of treasure? Yes. Maybe some of the statues, they are not of very high quality, so probably it was quickly made, and they want to actually give them as ornaments at the villas of the nobles, the nobility in Rome.
So you mentioned that some of the jewelry found on the ship has been found elsewhere. Do you think that there could be another Antikythera mechanism out there somewhere? Is this a one-of-a-kind object?
I don't think it could be one of the time objects, because when we made it, we made so many mistakes that they made part of it and then the other part wouldn't fit, etc., etc. We discarded the first part. So I have the feeling that probably the Antikythera mechanism was made. First of all, it was a very good collaboration between a very good scientist and astronomer and a mathematician and a charismatic artist who actually did the inscriptions and the cutting the gears, etc., etc.
It also had a use in predicting the Olympic Games. Who would have required something like this?
Well, it didn't have really a certain aim. I think it was probably an educational instrument. I can imagine Aristarchus, or probably Hipparchus in Rhodes, on the stadium there that he had his observatory, gathering his students around him and having the Antikythera mechanism there in front of him.
And doing astronomy outreach.
Look at this star, it's moving like this. Let's look at it on the Antikythera mechanism. And the moon, did you observe the moon? Did you see what is the phase of the moon? Let's rotate the Antikythera mechanism dials and find today's date. And look. The phase of the moon is exactly what we see now.
So in a similar way to an astrolabe is at an observatory now.
Yes, yes. This astrolabe could also be an astrolabe. We have found some evidence recently.
Mm. You said that whenever you study it, it brings you completely new ideas on what else it could do, because obviously you haven't found everything yet. Have you got any up-and-coming theories about new parts that you've only just discovered?
This is very, very, very difficult to say, because we still need to investigate a lot of things. Of course, I think that we do have the equation of time, which is something completely new.
Could you, for our listeners, could you quickly tell us what the equation of time is?
Oh, this is the difference between the time shown by a sundial, and because the moon and because the sun moves faster and slower as it moves in an elliptical orbit around the Earth as they knew at this time, they does not show the evenly flow of the mean solar time that our watches and our clocks show. You know, our clocks do not go faster and slower, but the sun does move faster and slower. But don't forget that the year is the rotation of the Earth around the sun. The day is the rotation of the Earth around its axis. So they're all astronomical calculations. So the difference between the shadow of the sun that shows on sundials the time and the mean solar time shown by our watches is the equation of time. It starts in January being negative, so we have to subtract a few minutes, goes further negative, then goes up again, it becomes positive, and again around June, then again negative, very negative, and it goes all the way up again, becomes very, very positive. That they say is something like between 14 and 16 minutes.
Does this equation change depending on where you are in the world?
It doesn't change on geographical latitude, but changes with time. Mm. And this is because we have the precession of the axis of rotation of the Earth around the axis of the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the orbital plane of the Earth around the Sun. So the axis of the ecliptic is perpendicular to this plane. And the Earth's axis forms 23.5 degrees around this axis and moves like this in 25,000 years. So it changes slowly.
It changes slowly, but it's still fairly accurate even now.
Oh, yes. It changes about 30 degrees per 2,000 years.
I think it keeps better time than my watch, actually.
Okay, yes.
But there are some things that change with the latitude that the object is at, which have given you some hints as to where it was actually used. Is that correct?
Okay, I did not explain this during my lecture. Let me explain it now. The Antikythera mechanism had inscribed in the front panel a parapigma. Now, a parapigma consists of astronomical events that happen once per year. You probably know that as the Earth moves around the Sun seems to be projected at different constellations from day to day or probably from month to month. There are 12 constellations in the orbital plane of the Earth around the Sun, which we call the zodiac constellations. So you are a certain zodiac and I'm a different one. From day to day, the Sun, as it moves among the stars, it goes close to a star, it passes it, and then it leaves it behind him. As the Sun moves close to the star, suddenly, there's one day that's so close that the star cannot be seen. The Sun sets, and the star sets behind him, but the Sun is so close to it that the star cannot be seen. This is called in ancient Greek the epitole, which is the closest point of the Sun to this star, during the setting of the Sun. The same thing then goes on. The Sun comes closer and closer to the star. It goes past it. And at daytime, when the sunrise comes, the star, rises first and the Sun behind it. You cannot see it. After a day, the Sun moves away by 1 degree away from the star. Another day, another degree. Eventually, there comes a day that the star is visible for the first time this year on the sky. This was a very, very important date in ancient times. For example, I know that the morning rising of the star Sirius, the brightest star on the sky, was very important to the Egyptians because the flooding of the Nile was coming immediately after, bringing new and fertile land in the Egyptian plains, and the pharaoh or the king was offering a big prize to the person who come to him and say, well, look, I have observed the morning rising of the star Sirius. There are events that happen once per year, and they also depend on the geographical latitude. So the sequence of these rising and settings that I described are different in the equator from the North Pole. In fact, in the North Pole, probably you know that the Sun doesn't rise for 6 months and rises. So, by studying the parapigma, we have found that the Antikythera mechanism could be used between 33 degrees geographical latitude and about 38.
Does that rule out Egypt? Could the person who owned this have? Yes. Couldn't have got the prize every year.
Yeah. We are surprised that it rules out Egypt because we're expecting to have some connection with the Egyptian calendar. In particular, because the calendar in the front side of the mechanism has Egyptian names. Okay. All of them were written in Greek letters, but it did have the names in Egyptian, not the Greek names. So we're expecting to have some connection with Egypt, but the parapigma tells us that it could not have been used there.
Wow. Do you have any idea why? Or is that one of the mysteries that there seems to be?
Because it was not made there. Although, of course, Alexandria is well known from ancient times, from people that constructed automata, like Eron of Alexandria and like Ctesibius, people that actually made some automatic machines to impress people. And these machines, though, impress us as well.
It impresses nowadays. Us all these years later, yeah. One question that I see you're asked a lot, which is a very good one, is this machine heliocentric or is it a geocentric machine?
The machine was a geocentric machine. So if you see in the front dial, you have the Earth in the middle and the pointers of the Sun, the Moon, they rotate around the Earth, around the observer. So it was a geocentric machine. However, I'm pretty sure that the guy that actually made that Antikythera mechanism knew about the heliocentric system, but it was a heresy at the time. So I presume he did not want to say this, and even more to construct such a system.
Would you say it's easier to construct a system like this for heliocentric versus geocentric?
Oh, by far easier. I mean, it is easily explained, the positions of Mars and the orbit of Mars and the planets around the Sun is much easier to explain with the heliocentric system. For the geocentric system, you have to have epicycles and different centers that the Earth is. There's also a different center in the solar system. I have the feeling that Aristotle used 53 cycles and epicycles for his model of the solar system in order to justify all the peculiar movements of the moon and the planets and the sky.
Yeah, it's incredible because that all boils down to some very fine mechanisms. And I've seen some of the shafts and some of the gears you showed them in your talk. They're just so precise. Were these made by machine tools or cutting materials?
Yes, we have found quite a lot about it in the literature. In particular, I would like to stay on a tablet found in LFCs. It is in a museum there. One can find it, where it describes buying of poles and square parts of the columns. You see,
so
in the ancient times...
List.
A shopping list. Come on, it's a shopping list. Okay, an order, a shopping order. Mm. You see, in the ancient times, when they built a monument or the Acropolis, in the middle, they used to put some metal. And this metal has to be very precisely made. And this is, in Eleftheros, is a description of a shopping list by somebody who would like to order things for doors to be opening and closing. And it particularly it says that you should lay the poles round so that they move freely inside the square parts of it, which have to be cut very accurately, and the side should be square and not deviate from this specimen that I give you. They, furthermore, they should be made out of bronze, and describes that bronze is 11 parts copper and 1 part tin.
So it's a very bespoke order.
Very, 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 very precise order.
That's just sent to some craftsmen.
It's like my wife giving me a list of shopping, and I have to go to the supermarket and say, what is this? I do not know what it is, but please give it to me.
So do you know if this mechanism was created all in one piece, or do you think it's been created over a period of time?
That's a very good question. First of all, you have not found in the Antikythera mechanism who constructed it. So we have not found the made in China. He's not there. We have not found it.
Would something like that have had a signature somewhere? If you have
Well, we have been looking at all the gears. We have been trying to find if there was a signature, and we have not found one. At least there were not that many astronomers that could do the maths and the astronomy, which is inbuilt in the Antikythera mechanism. I did mention Hipparchos a couple of times. Also, some people have suggested Archimedes, but Archimedes died three generations before the Antikythera mechanism was constructed. He was killed, and Syracuse, where he lived and worked, was destroyed by the Romans, and so no laboratories were actually left behind. So I can see that maybe somebody started working on the front part of the mechanism, describing the position of the sun and the moon, how fast the moon moves. You know, the moon moves once a month around the sky. The sun moves around in 360 degrees and per day for sunset and sun rising. So maybe somebody actually did this reconstruction of the front part, and then somebody who's a very clever person said, well, we can use the same movement of the sun and the moon to calculate other things. So they added the backside. Could be. We do not have any more evidence of what I'm telling you, but it could very well be.
This mechanism was lost, and there are no other examples of this in existence. How long was it before the next astronomical clock or something that did the same sort of thing as this came along? How many years?
Yes, I see your question has two parts. The one is why this technique was lost. That was the time that the Greeks were completely captured by the Romans. And what I see is that that a bird does not sing loudly and well in a cage. So artists and scientists probably did not want to work under oppression. The Romans were very good in road building, but they were not good in geometry, in astronomy, etc., etc. Then the other thing is, how long did it take until you calculated and made another machine which was similar to the Antikythera mechanism? I know of two other machines that were made before the Prague clock. Mm. One of them was made here in England. It was made by William of Wellingford in 1261, but it was not as complicated as the Antikythera mechanism. And the other one is the Astrarium of De Dondi in North Italy. Maybe around Padova, I'm not sure. The device that actually resembles in many aspects what the Antikythera mechanism did is the Prague clock, that if you go there, You can admire it and know that some parts of it could be taken from the Antikythera mechanism.
It's amazing. And that was maybe 1,000 years later that was created. 15 centuries later. And we still don't know everything that this mechanism does, because we don't have everything from it.
Yes, it's nice not to know everything, isn't it? Mm. I mean, just imagine if you know anything, life is going to be boring. So yes, every time that we actually investigate the Antikythera mechanism, we seem to be finding new results, and then we have to go back and investigate these results, read new journals, new books about the knowledge of the time of the Antikythera mechanism, and see if what we have found was well-known knowledge at the time, or if it's something completely new. So there's a challenge with the Antikythera mechanism. Every time that we look at it, we find something new and we do not know what it does.
And are you tempted to go back and look for more gears at the bottom of the ocean where it seems
Some marine excavations are being organized in collaboration between the Woods Hole Institute in Boston, United States, and the effort of marine archaeology in Greece, with very good results. I can describe some of them if you would like to. But we have not found anything about the Antikythera mechanism. They have found lots of other things concerning statues, concerning, a spear, a very, very well-preserved spear. They have found lots of metal parts. I do not know the very latest thing. I have to see one of the PhD students of the Aristotle University, who is an archaeologist and an architect at the same time. And he's a diver as well.
So he's perfectly equipped to grab everything.
He's the best person to actually go down and investigate.
But you will be back in a few months' time to give another talk at Manchester, is that correct?
Maybe. Nothing that has been fixed yet, but if it does...
Well, if you are, hopefully we'll be able to grab you again, because I could talk about this all day. It's really cool. But it would also be nice to talk to you about your research. So it'd be lovely to have you back on the Jocast in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to coming back, if I may, in Manchester, a place that I spent many of my years. Many moments I do remember from my studentship here at Jodrell Bank and at University of Manchester at the Schuster Laboratory with my professors. I think that the only moments that you actually have lived are the moments that we remember. Mm. Any other moments that we do not remember, they have just passed away from us. We do not remember them. We do not live them. Mm. So I have the feeling that it's nice that I came back. So many good and sweet memories came back to me.
This was the first time you've been invited to speak at Manchester since
Correct.
You left.
Correct.
Which is scandalous, really. Hopefully.
Okay, I have spoken in Oxford and have spoken in other places as well, and many other countries in the world.
Well, we really hope to have you back again. But thank you. This has been fascinating. Cheers.
Thanks for that, Charlie. And now we move on to the part of the show about things we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends.
Okay, so for my odd and end, I'm going to talk about this age map of the Milky Way, which has been created. So astronomers at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy have developed a couple of new tools for determining the age of red giant stars from its optical spectrum. These tools have then been applied to the Apogee Survey and NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, some data from there, and it gives estimates of the ages of nearly 100,000 stars throughout the Milky Way, which allows the MPIA team, led by astronomers Melissa Ness and Marie Martig, to create an age map of our galaxy. So they can tell you how old each of these stars is, and they know roughly where it is and how far away from the galactic centre it is. You can put these two values together and do a nice sort of colour scale map for the stars, and using this you can sort of test theories on the formation and evolution of the Milky Way. So one of the theoretical predictions for the evolution of a galaxy such as our own is that it started, the galactic stellar disk should have started forming from the inside, so near the galactic center, and then evolved outwards, so you'd have older stars in the middle and younger ones towards the edge. And the map created by these astronomers does confirm this prediction. So it's hard to describe this nice looking map on an audio podcast, so we'll put a picture of it in the show notes or a link to the press release. And one of my favourite things, as well as the cool scientific results, is one of the tools they use to identify or determine the ages of these red giant stars is called the Canon. So, and there's a long paper about what the Canon does and how it uses sort of benchmark stars with really well-defined ages and compares their spectrum to other stars. But it refers to it throughout, always as the Canon.
Is that an acronym? Because you're saying it as though it's all in capital letters.
It's always in italics. And I don't think it is an acronym. I think they just went for the Canon. There's got sentences in the paper like the Canon learns from the known label references. And
I'll also point out that not only is the word Canon in italics, but also the word the.
Yes, it is the Canon.
See, I just have now an image of one of those cannons that fires people in circuses, but except firing massive supergiant stars across the galaxy. How many stars did you say they measured? Was that 100,000?
About 100,000, yes.
So only, what, a millionth of the stars in the galaxy?
Yes, but if they're distributed throughout...
But it's pretty cool what you can do with a millionth of the stars in the galaxy, how much you can tell from that size of population.
And I believe this is sort of a starting point, because some of these surveys are going to provide more data as time goes on, so they'll be able to refine their map. And
using the Canon.
Using the Canon.
Okay, from one kind of spectra to another kind of spectra, there's another press release out this January on behalf of Swinburne University of Technology. So we got it through the Royal Astronomical Society in the UK. But this is a paper that's not actually out yet at the time of recording, but it's results that were presented at the American Astronomical Society meeting, which is always happens at the beginning of January in America. And so what this team have done is they've had a look at, through archive data, so this is not new data, but they've looked at spectra from... archive data looking for ancient gas clouds. What they're trying to find is evidence of the first gas clouds that were enriched by the first population of stars after the Big Bang. So the beginning of the universe, Big Bang happens, and you've got mostly hydrogen and helium. Some of that gas starts to collapse and you get stars forming. And then eventually those stars, the big ones anyway, start to go supernova and create heavier elements, which then go on to enrich the interstellar medium. Now, the gas that we see today in our own galaxy has been enriched by several generations of stars and contains lots of heavy elements. But the further back in the universe you go, the higher redshift you look at, the fewer of those heavy elements you find, because the fewer supernovae that have happened and the fewer heavy elements have been created. So what they've done is they've looked at this archive data and found in one particular case a gas cloud between us and a distant galaxy. And they can use that distant galaxy sort of like as a torch looking through the gas cloud and look at the absorption caused by that gas cloud that's in between. So they're not actually directly looking at the gas cloud. They're looking at the absorption caused by the gas in that cloud on the light from the background galaxy. And this works because every chemical element has a different spectrum. So when you look at the absorption lines, you can tell what chemicals are in the cloud by looking at where those spectral lines are. And so this is what they've done, and they've worked out that this particular gas cloud that they found was observed 1.8 billion years after the Big Bang. That's where it exists in time, that's where we're seeing the light from. And it looks, well, there are two possible explanations for the amount of chemicals that they're seeing in the cloud. One of them is that it's enriched by this first population of stars. Or another explanation is that it was actually a much later cloud, and it's actually been enriched by second generation stars as well. But they need a bit more data to kind of work that out. But it's pretty cool. It's the first time, I think, that a cloud enriched by first generation stars has been, well, thought to have been found anyway. So it's kind of cool.
Do we have any firm dates on when the first generation stars are about, or does this sort of put a limit on it?
Oh, I think this is one of the reasons why they're looking for this, is to actually try and put a better defined limit on when this population of stars actually existed.
Just one of the things to say alongside that, it's you mentioned this is like the first time we're seeing a first generation of stars, but this is like a first generation of star or gas from the first generation of stars in the early universe. I work with several people who work on dwarf galaxies who like to brag that their dwarf galaxies are like galaxies in the early universe, and that they too are places where there are very few heavy elements, and it's at least one object, one's Wiki 18 is the type of thing which may be undergoing its first early burst of star formation as well.
Yeah, absolutely, but with dwarf galaxies in the nearby universe are a lot easier to study than distant gas clouds. So this is why this is taking a lot longer, because it's a lot harder to do.
That's true. Although, on the other hand, dwarf galaxies are also much fainter and smaller. And they deserve your love.
I have nothing against dwarf galaxies. I am not sizist when it comes to galaxies. I like dwarf galaxies too. But I think this is really cool. I think it's that exciting.
And something else that's really exciting, that has really surprisingly gone unmentioned on the Jodcast for the last 2 months, is Myon-NEND. So this is about a person. It's about a man who's had considerable news coverage for the last 2 months or so. But we've neglected to talk about him on the Jocast at all.
Well, that's because I prefer not to get into American politics. And so, especially given some of the offensive comments made by some of the people running for office.
Luckily, this guy's not an American politician, but have we got any other guesses as to who it might be?
I can't believe that you've left him out if it's who I'm thinking of. Is it Tim Peake?
It's Tim Peake. Oh, it is indeed Tim Peake. So Tim was obviously the first British European Space Agency astronaut, and he went up onto the International Space Station on the 15th of December 2015. Some of us watched the launch live at Jodrell Bank. I don't know who else was there of here, but I was watching it on the television.
We were watching it in the lecture theatre.
So. Yeah. So we swapped round because usually Megan's at Jodrell Bank and I'm not. So.
Yeah.
And some people recorded a good luck message for him on the way as well, didn't they? So, I can't believe that he didn't make it into the last 2 months' worth of episodes. So what I did was I went through the news, I trawled through the news, and I tried to put together a diary of different things that he's been up to in space, some of the interesting things that have happened along the way. And actually, if you forget that he's sitting on the International Space Station at the moment, some of it sounds quite sad in a way. So for example, he tried to ring home over the weekend and he got an answer phone message because his parents had popped out, and this was the weekend after the launch, and that was the first time he tried to ring home. He got him in the end. He's also being replaced. Well, he was also replaced at his family Christmas dinner by a cardboard cutout called Flat Tim, which was made for him by the village where he lives. Made for his parents by the village in which they live. So I guess that's nice for them, but I don't know how I'd feel about a flat
pack astronaut.
Yeah.
Does he come with an Allen key?
But he's done some fun stuff as well. He got to watch Star Wars up there, which was nice. Apparently there was a copy waiting for him, which is pretty impressive. I wonder if he waited until the 17th.
So there was a copy up there before it came out.
Mm. Oh. And can you think of a better place to watch it? I guess it's pretty secure up there.
Yeah, but I can't imagine they've got a full like IMAX surround sound system out there.
So he when he went up, as per tradition, astronauts on a launch get to pick 3 songs that are played during the launch. Tim Peake was no exception. Can anyone ever think about any of the things that he might have chosen?
Please don't let it be Europe's Final Countdown.
No. That'd be a bit pessimistic.
No. The one that comes to my mind is Pink Floyd's Learning to Fly.
No. So he picks Queen's Don't Stop Me Now, U2's A Beautiful Day, and Coldplay's A Sky Full of Stars, and Adam is cringing.
Should have gone with the Pink Floyd option.
Yeah.
So that's what he has been getting up to. And actually, at time of recording, this hasn't happened. But we are endeavouring to get this episode out on the Jodcast birthday, which is the 14th. So if you are listening to this on our birthday, the day after, which is the 15th of January, he will be doing a spacewalk to repair a malfunctioning voltage regulator. And he will be the first British citizen to do a spacewalk. So that's very exciting stuff. And his antics will continue into the new year. In April, he's going to be running a marathon on the International Space Station. So
fixed in place, right? On a treadmill.
He will be on a treadmill, yeah. Yes.
Cool. We'd be doing a marathon at the same time as anything else that's happening on Earth.
We'd be doing it at the same time as the London Marathon.
Ah, well,
makes
sense.
Which is why it's April the 24th. He'll be starting at 10 a.m. GMT, and he's set himself 3.5 to 4 hours to do it. And he's done one before, but he's not trying to break a record, because I think that the folk down below are going to be monitoring him in lots of different ways. So I reckon it's pretty tricky to run a marathon on a treadmill in space.
Yep. So. There are just issues with bone and muscle loss up in space as well with astronauts. And I suspect that a lot of the medical science in terms of people living in weightlessness has advanced over the decades that we've had people up in space. But that would be a serious concern.
So astronauts have to exercise for about 2 hours a day while they're up there. And he'll be coming to the end of his tenure, which is 6 months, I think, by April. So, yeah, he'll. I think part of the mission is to observe what happens to the human body over that period of time in space. So, yeah, it'd be really interesting stuff. And good luck to him. Hopefully he'll have better luck than when he tried to call home on Christmas Eve and accidentally rang a grandma who hung up on him thinking that he was drunk. When he said, "Hello, is this Earth?"
So my odd and end is kind of a relatively straightforward type of thing. The American Astronomical Society just held its annual winter meeting. They have two meetings every year, and the meetings are among the largest astronomy meetings in the world, and they generate lots and lots of press releases. And I think some of the other odds and ends which we've heard came from that. And the one that I wanted to talk about was something which I first saw on the BBC website, which was about Chandra observations of M51, which is also known as the Whirlpool Galaxy. Chandra is an X-ray observatory, which has been in space for well over a decade. It's done lots of great stuff. It's observed M51 before, but in this particular observation, the astronomers decide to focus on a different part of M51. For people who aren't quite familiar with this galaxy, it's an interacting system. It's actually one of the best examples of an interacting galaxy system close to the Milky Way galaxy. There's the really big spiral galaxy, which gives the Whirlpool Galaxy its name. That's called NGC 5194. And then that is physically connected to a weird kind of spheroidal type galaxy, which astronomers don't know how to classify, which is named NGC 5195. Most people, including me in my previous publications, usually look at the big, pretty spiral galaxy and just ignore the poor little spheroidal thing, partly because it's like we don't know what to make of the spheroidal thing and partly because we're interested in big spirals.
So you like spirals and you like dwarfs, but not spheroidals.
Well, indeed, because it's like, from my particular perspective, it's I've actually published a few papers with M51, and by work in infrared data, typically infrared data tends to look very blurry compared to images most other wave bands, because it's the wavelength of light is longer and you have to build really big telescopes to actually make the images not look blurry. But then you also have to put the telescopes in space because the Earth's atmosphere also produces lots of infrared emission. So it's like in all of the images, all of the infrared images I have seen of M51, NGC 5195 looks like a dot. Well, except for the Spitzer 8 micron image where you can actually see a little bit of a weird freakish tidal tail which comes out of the center. But most other images, it looks like a dot. However, it doesn't look like a dot in the Chandra X-ray data because X-ray telescopes typically have excellent spatial resolution. They can see stuff with like really great detail. As I was saying, astronomers decide to focus on the spheroidal galaxy in the Whirlpool Galaxy system. They actually came up with a rather complicated image of the structure of the X-ray emission in the center. They found X-ray emission from a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy. This isn't terribly surprising because it's astronomers have seen X-ray emission from a lot of supermassive black holes in the centers of lots of galaxies. It does sound like I'm making it sound like we're just sort of like overwhelmed with supermassive black holes these days, and to the average astronomer, they've seen so many that's no longer that special. But you know, it's for general public, I could still see it sort of exciting that people are looking at a supermassive black hole.
Hey, I think they're exciting.
How can you distinguish between one another though? I reckon they all look pretty similar, right?
They actually look very different.
The galaxies about them look different.
Well, no, the black holes themselves also look different, too.
The jets are different and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'm actually working on one right now where it's... I'm not going to give away too much of my research until it's published, but I'm working on a galaxy right now with a supermassive black hole, which is completely obscured by interstellar dust. And I'm actually not doing much more with the black hole beyond that, but it's... I can just pretend it's not there. But in any case, to get back to NGC 5195, what astronomers found that was really interesting in this is that they found a couple of bow shocks, which they refer to in the press release as burps. Now, it looks like there were a couple of waves of gas that were blown out of the region around the black hole, not out of the black hole itself, mm-hmm. but of the region around the black hole. One of these shock waves was blown out about 3 million years ago, and the other one was blown out about 6 million years ago. And it's a rather pretty picture from the Chandra X-ray Observatory. And one of the inane reasons why I wanted to talk about this was because when I saw the original news article on the BBC website, they misidentified the poor dwarf galaxy. So they identified the dwarf spheroidal galaxy as NGC 5194, or they made some other confusing comments. But they said the burst was coming from NGC 5194. Now, the BBC corrected their news article a few hours later. But if you go to the Internet Archive and use the Wayback Machine, you can go back to when the article was first posted and see they accidentally got the name incorrect.
So what was the correct name?
The object is NGC 5195.
And what do the numbers actually stand for in this case? Because in different sort of objects, they mean different things, right?
Well, they're just catalog numbers. In this case, the... object is the 5,195th object in the New General Catalog, which was a catalog of objects put together in the late 1800s of it's a catalog of nebulae and clusters, but back in the 1800s, nebulae included both the things that we would still call nebulae, gas clouds within the Milky Way galaxy, as well as galaxies outside the Milky Way, which people didn't realize at the time were objects
outside the Milky Way.
Anything faint and fuzzy, basically.
Yeah, that became a great debate about like 50 years or so after the or 40 or 50 years after the catalog was put together.
About whether galaxies were inside or outside the Milky Way. Yeah.
And we still call it the New General Catalog.
The right general catalog.
So the next one has to be like the very new or the extremely
the ultra new.
Yes.
Well, people.
Going by astronomical well, there, conventions.
There was the UGC, which I believe stands for
Uppsala
General Catalog. And there's also the PGC, which I can't recall what that stands for. And then you have like lots of telescopes now. We'll do things like all sky surveys and we'll create their own names for everything, but the names are really boring. So it's like the 2-mass survey, the 2-micron all sky survey. You produce names for lots and lots of objects in the sky, but the name sort of consists of the word 2-mass followed by a large series of numbers which relate to the coordinates of the object.
So the BBC corrected their mistake, right?
Oh, yes.
But someone who's never been wrong is Joe Zuntz, who now answers your astronomical questions in Ask an Astronomer.
Hello and welcome to Ask an Astronomer. I'm Hannah, and with me is Joe Zuntz, who is our astronomer this week. So our first question is from Kenny McLeod. I think that's how you pronounce it. If not, I'm sorry. He has two questions, actually. The first part is, I'm confused about the main cause of redshift in distant galaxies. Is it because galaxies are moving apart relative to space-time, or is it because space-time itself is expanding?
The answer is the latter. Space-time itself is expanding. If you try and make sense of things in a Newtonian or relativistic or special relativistic framework, where the galaxies themselves are moving, which is how Edwin Hubble originally saw things when he measured this effect first, then you very quickly run into problems. Things like you find the galaxies have to go faster than light in some situations, or problems like that. So actually, our understanding of it is that space-time itself is expanding rather than just the galaxies themselves moving. Yes.
So it seems like these other galaxies are moving faster than the speed of light to us.
Potentially, yes. So observationally, it looks exactly the same as if, or for small local galaxies, it looks exactly the same as if the galaxy is just moving away from us. So that's why we originally thought of it this way. But actually, when you look at things on a more large scale, when you have to use general relativity, the full Einsteinian picture of gravity to explain things, then you really do have to think of things a little bit differently, yeah.
And so the second part of his question is, does that mean that the expansion of space stretches the light, giving it a longer wavelength and a lower frequency, hence the redshift effect? And if that's the case, would that make light the only ruler by which the expansion of the universe can be measured, as it's the only thing in our universe that has some of its properties affected by the expansion, e.g. the frequency is affected but not speed?
So the first caveat here is that metaphors like stretching can sometimes mislead you when you're thinking about relativity. But basically, yes, you can think of the expansion of space as stretching photons out and causing redshift. That's one of the ways we visualize that thing happening. Now, the real explanation for that is a little bit more complicated and involves a relationship between density and pressure in radiation and how that is different from matter. But the basic idea is that, yes, the basic way we think of it is that the expansion of space is stretching photons. Now, to the second part of that question, light isn't actually the only thing that's measurable like this. Firstly, gravitational waves, for one thing, also are redshifted in the same kind of way. But photons are certainly the only easily detectable individual thing that's redshifted and stretched in the same kind of way that we can observe directly as seeing the expansion. But as well as looking for individual objects, and this is a fortunate thing for our observations, we can also look at groups of objects, and in particular, the distribution of galaxies across the sky. Is a very good example. It turns out there's a characteristic scale and of the clustering of galaxies, so that groups of galaxies tend to come in blobs of a particular size, which is about 150 megaparsecs, or about 500 light years. And that size is also stretched out as the universe expands, because it's made of galaxies, or galaxies are the thing that's defining that size, so as they expand apart, this scale expands too. Now, this effect, which is called baryon acoustic oscillations, is one of the most important cosmological probes. So it's true that as an individual object or an individual observational kind of unit, the only thing we can see being stretched is photons. But if we look at ensembles of objects or patterns in the sky, we can see those being stretched as well.
So the next question is from Martin. Again, it's in two parts. The first part, the speed of light is the fastest anything goes through space. Is there a limit to how fast space itself can expand?
The answer is no. There's no limits in known physics. We don't know of a limit. There's nothing built into GR, general relativity, with rules about this that controls this.
So in the early universe, did that expand faster than light then?
Yes, absolutely. We think that in an early period of the universe, the inflationary period, that did happen. And that's not a problem for any kind of relativity at all.
Okay, so that leads on quite nicely to the next part of the question. Are there any theories that suggest the expansion of space was effectively infinite at t equals zero, the Big Bang, and then fell? That conflicts with supernova type 1a evidence, which is that the rate of expansion is increasing, but I'm not sure how well type 1a supernova are understood.
So another important caveat here, the period very near t equals zero, the very, very early part of the universe, is still quite uncertain, both observationally and theoretically. It's likely to stay that way observationally because it's very, very hard to probe that part of the universe except very indirectly. But, you know, theories are always being developed for this period. Having said that, the basic models have cosmic expansion dominated by radiation in this early period, which we call the pre-inflationary period. And in these models, the expansion rate does tend to infinity as you get closer and closer to the beginning of the universe. Now, we suspect that other physics will come into play at some point, and this won't be the entire story, and so we don't really like this idea of infinities in general, but that is kind of the basic model of this thing. Now, this doesn't conflict with the supernova evidence that you talked about. The accelerated expansion really happens much, much later. So the first supernova we can actually observe are hundreds of millions of years later than this very, very early period of near the Big Bang. And the switch on of dark energy, as we call it, so the period when acceleration of the universe appears to begin, is typically around 5 or 10 billion years ago, so much, much later than this kind of very early Big Bang phase. So there's no contradiction between this evidence and the theory.
Final question from Philip King. Is it possible for a gravitational lens to allow us to see the same object different distances and ages?
The answer is yes, absolutely, and it's a really exciting observation. So strong gravitational lenses can produce multiple images of the same object. We sometimes see things called Einstein quartets or Einstein rings, which are multiple pictures of the same thing. And typically we're seeing multiple copies of the same background galaxy or quasar around this, sort of distributed around the same foreground cluster. The different light paths that go to these images, or rather come from these images, can be different lengths. There's no reason they should all be the same. And that means we're seeing the object at different times. The delays are different from the light to get from there to us. So we're seeing it at different times. Now this leads to a really interesting cosmological probe where we can measure the universe, which is called a time delay lens. So if we can measure the time difference between these paths and also model the power of the lens, then we can understand the geometry of the universe much, much better in the distance to this object. Now, the most spectacular example of this time delay difference happened very recently when a supernova nicknamed the Refstal supernova was seen going off multiple times. And the final version of that, the final explosion that we saw, actually happened in November 2015 and was predicted in advance. So we saw a first collection of explosions and then we predicted the last one happening many, many years later. So it was a fantastic validation of our model for this gravitational lens and our model and our understanding of this gravitational lensing picture. And it's really important for measuring the expansion history of the universe as well.
Yeah, I think we talked about that on a previous Jodcast, actually. I think it was one of my odds and ends, actually. It was a really cool system. I think that was the one where you had, it was lensed by a cluster and then that one of those images was then lensed by a foreground galaxy, is that right?
I don't know the details, but very possibly, yes. It's also believed that the very first image of those things actually happened in 1988 with nobody watching. So we saw a middle group of them, mm-hmm. and then we saw it. And so part of the question here, I think Philip's asking, is can we sort of see the evolution of objects? With these spectacular supernovae apart, you typically can't, because the time delay differences tend to be too short on the kind of stellar lifetime thing. So it's not like we can see, system we've seen so far, we can't see an object and say, okay, here it is when it's a young galaxy, here it is when it's an old galaxy. So it's only with these really kind of spectacular evolutions that happen very quickly, like supernova, that we can really, you know, we can see the development happening in real time.
I think one of the primary images is due to go off at some point in the future.
Oh, there's
as
still
well.
Another one to come.
Yeah, that's excellent. The last one as well. So I think it's also, you can use that to work out the Hubble constant, can't you?
You can, yes. So it's a little bit uncertain. So the problem is that if you want to know the Hubble constant exactly, you have to also know the distribution of matter in the lens pretty exactly as well. So there's what we call a degeneracy in this problem, which is that you can get the same observational effect either by changing the mass of the lens or the distribution of the lens, or by changing the Hubble constant. So there's a bit of a problem there in the observations. But with more observations and with more modelling, we can really, really try and pin things down. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Joe. That was really interesting.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Hannah and Joe. So now we're going to move on to something that I'm going to call the live section, Jodcast Live. You may have heard that Jodcast Live is happening, and I think everyone here is going to be putting a part in that.
I hope so, yes. It's already in my calendar.
We've got some great stuff planned. We've got some great guests as well. I think I'm allowed to actually say who the guests are now. So we have confirmed coming Chris Lintott from The Sky at Night, and I think he's our most interviewed guest on the Jodcast ever, actually. So he'll be boosting his record up.
Jane Greaves has done an awful lot of interviews.
I've done some research, and I'm willing to stake a bet that Chris Lintott is the highest interview person.
Okay, we will check those numbers, and we will.
Yeah, we will be checking
that for Jodcast Live.
And even if that's not quite right, I reckon he's probably the guest who has spoken the most or has the most cumulative airtime on the Jodcast.
And about a variety of different topics as well. We will hopefully be having the Jodfather himself, Stuart Lowe.
Yay!
Were any of you around? Megan must have been around because she started it with him.
Stuart was still doing it when I started as well.
Stuart was gone by the time I got here.
I've never met him either, so it'd be really cool. We've also got David Ault coming, another of the founding fathers of the Jodcast, who you may have heard a few episodes back, actually, in the Christmas pantomime, which he wrote once again. And Dr. Jane Gupta will be coming along as well. And Mark Perver, who is the only one of them that I've met. So.
Jen not like being called the Jod Mother. Is that right? Because we should call her that.
So we're going to be coming up with lots of trivia for the Jocast episode, I'm sure, of who's done the most interviews and that sort of thing. But you can now apply for tickets to come and see us. It's going to be on Sunday, the 28th of February, and it's going to be at Jodrell Bank Observatory at 2 p.m. And we'll be putting up lots more information about the show as we go along. But if you go to www.jodcast.net/live, you can fill in a form and apply for some tickets to come along to the show. It'd be really interesting to see if any of the listeners have been listening for 10 years.
Mm.
I'm not sure.
Any dedicated?
Yeah, really cool. We've had messages in the past from people who went to the last Jodcast Live, which was 2010.
I think it was
2010.
That one I dialed in remotely from Australia, and the idea was they were going to have a screen with my head on it, or like Holly from Red Dwarf, you know, with a blackout and everything. So it was just my head, but in the end, they didn't have enough TV monitors. What a shame!
But what we did have was coconut halves because we did the pantomime because it was in December
we did live music,
yeah. Live sound effects. So I was sort of underneath a table.
Were
clopping.
You a horse?
Yes. Yeah. And we had a swanny whistle and all kinds of... I can't remember what the pantomime was that year, but...
So that's fun. Exactly why you have the coconut shells.
Yes, they're still in my office 6 years later, so...
So yeah, Jodcast Live will be great. Also, at the time that this goes out, we'll be slap bang in the middle of Stargazing Live, which is the annual BBC celebration of all things astronomical. And on the Friday episode, obviously, they'll be talking about Tim Peake because he'll be doing his... spacewalk, which will be really cool. But also, Manchester's a bit involved this year because we're doing something to do with the Citizen Science Project using the Zooniverse, Chris Lintott's Zooniverse. So in the past, they've done things like search for supernovas using people logging in from computers all over the world to look at pictures and to look for gravitational lenses as well. I think this year they're going to be searching for pulsars. You always hear lots about pulsars on the Jodcast. So that'll be really interesting. I've had a look at some of the images that you're able to see if you make a Zooniverse account and do this. And they sort of look like TV static, but you're looking for a line, a straight line zooming right up the middle, which shows that there's a pulsar there. That will be covered in Tuesday's episode of Stargazing Live, which is the 12th. And that Zooniverse project will be around for hopefully forever, as long as they can keep putting data into it. So definitely take a look.
One thing pulsars don't seem to be short of is data.
Yeah,
and if any Jodcast listeners happen to be in or around London at the end of the first week in February, the 5th and the 6th, Astrofest is on in London, in Kensington, again this year. And they have a rather interesting speaker lineup. They have Dr. Brian May, who of course has a PhD in astrophysics, the Brian May from Queen.
Tim Peake will be gutted to miss it then.
Who else is there? There is Dr. Alan Chapman, who is a historian of science, who always tells really interesting stories about somebody from the astronomical history. I believe he's talking about Robert Hooke this year. There's also Matt Taylor, who's the Rosetta mission scientist. What is his official title? Is that?
I think that'll do. Yeah.
And there is me. I'm actually going to be giving a lecture as well on the same bill as the rest of those illustrious people, and I'm a little bit nervous. So if you happen to be in London on the 5th of February, do come down and say hello.
So as a Jodcaster on the same table as Brian May, I'm hoping you're going to bring along a piece of recording equipment and try and snag an interview.
I will take my little field recorder that I bought to do the news when I went overseas, and I will see if I can snag an interview. I did ask him very nicely 10 years ago when we first started the Jodcast, because that was around the time he just finished his PhD.
What's that story?
I did ask him. Well, so it was around the same time that they closed the London Planetarium as well, and Brian May had a rant on his blog about this and how terrible it was and how important science was. And I sent him an email through his website asking for permission to quote it, expecting to not get a response. But I did. I got a response from Brian May. Saying,
himself?
Yeah, himself. Not his secretary, no. Saying, yes, absolutely, by all means, do quote it. I nearly came to Jodrell Bank to do my PhD many years ago when he first started.
Must have been loads to talk about.
Yeah, well, so I did ask him if he'd do an interview, on Skype at his convenience, but he was too busy. So I will, if I get to meet him, I will try again. Absolutely.
Maybe his schedule will have settled in 10 years. Maybe it'll be even more busy.
He seems to be even more busy than he was these days, but we'll see.
And now on to the feedback. So we've had no posts, and we did a tally of all the Christmas cards we got in the end, which is one more than any other year, I think. So hopefully we'll be able to beat that in the coming years with a Christmas card collection. Might be able to hang them up in the office somewhere. We've had a few Facebook messages and a few emails, but they've all been about the fact that the Jogcast servers have been struggling to serve properly over the last month or so. We're working on fixing it up. They seem to be up and working properly now, but in the meantime, we do have backup episodes stored on a second server, and we have links to them on Facebook and on Twitter and on the website. So if you can't download it on iTunes and you can't download it on the website, then go to our front page and you'll see a link to another server, and that will definitely work for downloading the episodes. We've had a tweet from Dr. Helen Mason, and she tweeted about an interview that she did for the Jogcast in 2006 March, which was 10 years ago. I think that was Stuart Lowe's first interview, actually. Do you remember that episode, Megan?
From 10 years ago, I can't say that I do. I do remember Helen Mason, though, because she has the most fantastic curly hair. So I remember meeting Helen, but I can't say I remember the interview. No, I'd have to go listen to the episode again.
And we've had a few more questions via Twitter for Ask an Astronomer as well, but we are still running low, so it'd be great if we could grab some more of those from you by whatever means necessary.
So you can find us on iTunes. Please rate and review us there.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jogcast.net.
And Twitter at twitter.com/jogcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jogcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jogcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jogcast.
And don't forget that you can send us posts, and the address is on the website. So I guess all that's left is to thank people. So special thanks to Professor John Seradakis and Jean-François Robitaille for the interviews. The editors were Ben Shaw and Charlie Walker. The producer was Charlie Walker. And lastly, I think we should probably thank you, the listeners, for sticking with us for, well, sticking with me for about 6 months, but sticking with the Jogcast for 10 years.
Yes, thank you very much.
So we shall now go and enjoy birthday cake.
Mm, yay. Which we have on the table in front of us.
It smells delicious.
So until next time, Jog on.